The Athletic.
Yesterday, it was made pretty clear who the dominant team in Manchester are.
Rodri through, Haaland to finish it, tucks it away, left foot beyond Onana, and Erling Haaland says that will do for this Manchester derby.
Yet Erik ten Hag said afterwards that the gap in quality between the two sides wasn't that big. Is he right? And if there is a summer of sweeping changes at United, is this likely to also mean a change of manager at Old Trafford? I'm Ayo Akinwolere. Welcome to the Athletic FC podcast. I'm joined by The Athletic's David Ornstein and Manchester United writer Laurie Whitwell. Both were actually at the game yesterday and they witnessed Manchester City beat Manchester United at 3-1. Start with you, Laurie.
I thought it was a really compelling game, actually, because you knew going into it that United were going to have to defend well. They weren't going to have a lot of the ball. City were going to probe and pick away at them. But the first sort of 10-15 minutes was fascinating in the sense of the speed of City's attacks, the kind of the pace that they started with, the intensity, which I guess, again, we expected. But United were really compact. The defenders kept spaces smartly and astutely. You could tell they were working hard. And then they had that threat on the break. And OK, they were winning the ball quite deep, but they did have those outlets. You know, Erik ten Hag's decision to play Bruno Fernandes as a sort of false nine, perhaps with a free role. And then Scott McTominay as a number 10 that could get up and down the pitch really did give United a bit of potency on those fast breaks. And obviously they scored from one of them. Andre Onana picking out Bruno Fernandes really well. Bruno Fernandes is the highest player for United, just staying onside, and then picking out Rashford. And obviously that strike is just absolutely incredible, and probably, yeah, one of the best goals I've ever seen live, for sure, just with the speed of it and the stunning nature of it as well, not only the quality but also the fact that City were then trailing, and then that gave United something to hold on to, a bit of jeopardy. City perhaps were a bit panicked at times and weren't quite playing their usual rhythmic sense, but obviously they did also create chances, had that incredible miss from Haaland. So, and then ultimately in the second half, their squad told, their kind of ability to keep going told, United tired, and you had players that were already coming into the game with a little bit of an injury in terms of Rashford and Johnny Evans having to come off, and I did think that changed what United were able to do. And then, yeah, Phil Foden scores another incredible goal as well. So it was in a sense of a footballing occasion, a pleasure to be there, but obviously with a United hat on, it just shows the kind of steps that United still need to go on to even get close to City.
David, Marcus Rashford, big week for him, really. An interview in the Players Tribune and listen to the Talk of the Devils podcast, mixed reviews from Manchester United fans either side. He had a point to prove. You know, I think that quote, what is it? If you back me, good. If you doubt me, even better. Sort of something that chimes through from that piece.
Those were actually the words he signed off that written piece in the Players Tribune. And so clearly it was the message he wanted to leave everybody with. And when you see an article like that, your immediate thought, and this was raised by many, is, well, you need to now back your words up with actions and deliver on the pitch, which is your sort of raison d'etre. It's your career. And he did exactly that with a quite jaw-dropping strike that stunned the Etihad and everybody watching it. It was almost like it had to be him. It was poetic. And the strike itself was out of this world. But what it meant at that moment in time and signified, he really did stand up to the plate. And I've got to back Marcus Rashford as a footballer. We've seen from the moment he burst onto the scene with those European goals and then a double against Arsenal, he stepped up with that penalty at Paris Saint-Germain. There have been many iconic moments, even, you know, when he was reprimanded for arriving late at Wolves for the bus. He then scored, and recently when it was against Wolves again, he delivered when the pressure was on. And clearly there was a lot of sort of emotion and frustration and anger in what he unleashed. And it was interesting after the game hearing Kyle Walker describe it as hammerfoot. He said that they've known all about that at England. They see it in training. And perhaps, of course, Manchester United fans will feel they've seen it too infrequently in recent seasons, and you know, the season before last was really concerning in Marcus Rashford's performance and his demeanour, but he responded spectacularly for the most part of last season with his goal tally and performances, and then it's gone awry a little bit again, and there may be many factors behind that. It must be just, you know, really aggravating for Manchester United fans that they know the player in there. They know how much he cares. I think we all do. This is a guy who, as he articulates very nicely in that piece, has grown up in the area, has had some very tough times, has been Manchester United through and through. I think he said he played 2 games on trial for Manchester City's academy, but immediately told his family he wanted to go back at Man United and give everything to make it there. And so I don't think his commitment to Manchester United should be questioned, but it is fair to scrutinise his performances. And there is admiration and interest in him from the continent. And we've heard it with PSG and Barcelona in the past. And they know what a quality player and athlete and character he can be when he's on it. I was at the Emirates earlier this season when he scored that fantastic goal against Arsenal. So it's that consistency that he'll be striving for at club level. And then in recent times, England has almost been his happy hunting ground, his salvation from the strife at Manchester United. And he's excelled there. He's looked happier. It feels like he has actually risen in the estimation of Southgate's, and perhaps at the perfect time heading into the Euros, because this is a massive moment for him, for club and country. He's just been put on a huge contract at Manchester United, so he has to deliver. The new hierarchy at Old Trafford will be expecting that, and his country will too. The way he responded from the missed penalty in the Euros final last time, I'm sure will be burning up inside him. And there is so much talk around Marcus Rashford. He does need to deliver now. He did in that moment against City, but he then missed a very presentable chance shortly after and didn't really impact the game much more beyond that. There was the run that saw Kyle Walker bring him down, and then Erik ten Hag revealed afterwards that he'd been playing with injury. So listen, I think we've got a responsibility in our reporting around somebody like him, and I wish him only the best and would like to see him flourish as much as anybody else.
Laura, do you think that injury was had a part to play? Because we look at that one-on-one against Kyle Walker where he just, I mean, he had a fair head start and it just didn't look up for it, did he?
Yeah, I mean, usually you see him burst onto the ball and straight away with it. Okay, Kyle Walker is a very fast fullback.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
know,
for sure.
It'd be interesting to see them, you know, in a 100-metre sprint, you know, just fully fit. I think it did have an impact, though. But I think it looked to me like he perhaps wasn't totally sure that he could stretch himself in the way that he wanted to. And then, obviously, he gets the arm on the shoulder. You know, referees sometimes give those. It probably would have been a soft one. And to be fair, Erik ten Hag afterwards, you know, he kind of rode back. At the time, he was right in front of us and he threw his water bottle down in frustration and anger because the foul hadn't been given. But when then he watched it back and he sort of said, okay, it would have been soft, but you know, traveling at that kind of speed, it doesn't take much to put you off balance. And but in my mind watching it, it felt like maybe Rashford sort of felt he was losing the duel, and that was the best way to make the most of the situation, which again, like I say, could have been a foul, but the referee decided against it, which is fair enough. Yeah, I think the injury did seem to then play a part in that instance. Not so much in the one in the first half, where again he broke beyond Kyle Walker and he just didn't control it in the way that he would like. That would have been a really good opportunity if he'd managed to sort of knee that ahead of himself and get a one-on-one with Edison. And then also that cross, I think, from Bruno Fernandes, where he sort of miscues it at the far post. Again, so these were the kind of moves that United were putting together that actually, with a bit more finesse and sort of the right choice in that moment, would have produced a really good goal-scoring opportunity. Because when you look at the stats, you know, the number of touches in the box for United. So, for example, you know, I think they had 3 total shots overall, 1 big chance, which obviously isn't the one that Rashford actually scored with. So these are small numbers compared to, you know, City having 27 shots. But I think they would have had more opportunities if they'd been able to connect in the right way. Or, you know, for example, in the second half, Alejandro Garnacho gets, you know, tackled by Edison. Again, it's a tough one. I mean, I know he gets the ball, but it's quite forceful. So, but anyway, the referee gives it as a goal kick. But those are the moments that United needs to capitalise on. And Rashford in full fitness, I think, would have done. But yeah, there's a wider conversation, as David's touched on, as you're alluding to there, Aero, in terms of Marcus Rashford and the Players' Tribune column before the game. you know, he obviously feels at this moment perhaps a little bit embattled, where, you know, he's being questioned by a lot of fans. You know, it doesn't take much for a Rashford clip to go viral online. You know, it does feel that there's an eagerness with which to analyse his performances off the ball, I would say. So it's not even that his goal scoring has dipped this season. It's been more those occasions where it's felt like he hasn't perhaps fully committed to tracking a runner or pressing. He, I'm sure, will say that he does, and he can't do it all the time because then he needs to conserve some of his energy for those attacking bursts at the threatening end of the pitch. But that's the kind of thing that fans will drill into and look at. And then obviously when you have a night out in Belfast and miss training the next day, which is what he mainly was talking about, I think, in that Players Tribune column, sort of defending himself in that regard, you know, in terms of saying that there was stuff out there in the public that isn't true. But that kind of adversarial approach, I don't know if it necessarily strikes the right tone with the kind of match going fans. It might work, it might play really well on social media with fans that, you know, watch it from afar, which is fair enough, and, you know, they will say, well, actually this is him fighting his own corner. But obviously with stuff like that, with a column, it goes through an editing process, and as David said, yeah, clearly this is what Rashford wanted to say, but I feel like you perhaps get more buy-in from the wider public and fans if it's a sort of face-to-face to camera kind of interview. A
couple of mitigations. I think it was around the time of the last Euros, he was playing through, was it a shoulder injury, Laurie?
Yeah.
He could have had surgery. He put it off for Manchester United, and that was to his detriment, and he ended up having to have it, and he then missed football subsequently. There's also been huge change, and he's been one of the most consistent presences, whatever you think of his performance, throughout that time. Yeah, there are long-serving players, your Luke Shaws, but many others have come and gone, and even the consistent ones like Shaw have had injuries and they're in and out of the team. Marcus Rashford has been there throughout. Different tactics, different people, different style of play, different things going on off the pitch with the club at ownership level, etc. I'm not saying that has a direct correlation, but compared to, say, a Manchester City, where somebody like Phil Foden is coming through, it is not settled and has not been at Manchester United. Then you get his position. He was more central last season and it seemed to be beneficial. There'd been a lot of debate around him on free kick duty, and then it moves over to Bruno Fernandes when Marcus Rashford was on that, or penalties. The more central role seemed to be to his liking, whatever people think about where he excels. Yet when Rasmus Højlund comes in, he gets pushed into different positions that are maybe not so much to his liking. And then on the sort of off-field side that he brings up in this Players Tribune piece, you know, he hints at reasons he feels behind this and says, I'll say no more on that, when he's referring to people speculating on the price of his jewellery and his range of cars and receiving parking tickets. I totally get what he's saying. There are others in football throughout the country and the world who are doing that sort of thing and not being picked up in the newspapers and being photographed time after time. So there is sympathy there, but there's also a bit that he has to do on his part too. So Laurie references the night out, and it was well documented on The Athletic, and there have been a number of incidents where you kind of think to yourself, it takes two to tango. Like, a bit of maturity and common sense from everybody involved in this would hopefully try and make this a better situation for everybody involved. And one more point I just wanted to say around Rashford and the Players Tribune piece. He talks about the pressure, really, he had, the role he took in his family, and the strain that it put on them, the travels to the cliff and taking multiple buses. They didn't have cars, and you can sense the kind of responsibility on his shoulders and the income he brings in, for example. I don't think he's unique in that by any means. That happens to many players across football and different nationalities. But I think it adds another perspective to all of this, that the local boy, Dungood, all eyes on him. Maybe he is held to different standards than other players, and in a way that's unfair, but it's something clearly he has to live with, and he accepts that.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
You're listening to the Athletic FC podcast with Ayo Akinwolere.
Yeah, I guess from a sporting point of view as well, Erik ten Hag, after the match, was talking about, you know, the gulf between both clubs, right, at this moment in time, and it seemed to allude that that gulf didn't seem that big. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think he was talking about one-off games. I mean, listen, you can still debate that, can't you? Because, you know, City had 73% possession and 27% for United, and the flow of the game was very much in City's favour. Now, what he will say, and what I think is a fair consideration, is that United had 8 players out through injury, and just generally the squad building that has taken place to this point is vastly different to the squad building that has taken place at Manchester City, who have had, David says, Pep Guardiola as their manager, you know, for several seasons now. The squad has been built even before his arrival to include players that would suit his style. That hasn't been the case at United. And again, that goes into the Rashford debate where, you know, has a squad been built for a particular style of play? Under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, possibly, yeah, because you've got the kind of counter-attacking style that Rashford seemed to thrive in. But then it's changed with Ralf Rangnick and then Erik ten Hag again. So I do think that's a very valid point for a player like Rashford who's come through the academy and has had these different instructions at different points. But yeah, in terms of what Erik ten Hag was saying, United gave City a decent game in the FA Cup final. They obviously beat them at Old Trafford last season, but they got, you know, destroyed at the Etihad last season as well. And this felt on that spectrum closer to that kind of performance. I think his point is that, yeah, we can give them a game in any one-off occasion, but the wider point that he's probably deliberately neglecting is the fact that over the course of a season, the gap is huge. You know, it's been consistently big for several seasons now, and you don't really see a way that United can sort of bridge that gap in the near future, given Pep Guardiola's position and the squad that still needs to be refined. I mean, United, you know, as the subs they brought on yesterday, you know, Antony being one of them, an £86 million player, you know, Amrabat, an £8.5 million loan fee for the season. You know, these are players that you'd like to think could actually come on and enhance the team, but actually each substitution that Erik ten Hag made, kind of had to make, the team got worse, whereas, you know, Pep Guardiola's able to bring on Julian Alvarez, who helped set up the second goal. Now, he was not an expensive transfer, but a very good one, who's then gone on and won the World Cup. So it's not all about the money you spend, but the depth of quality and the depth of experience that City have just far outweighs Manchester United at this point.
I think you're right. And David, I guess you're an interesting person to come to this in terms of that recruitment. And, you know, fair enough, Manchester United have got, what, Rasmus Højlund, Luke Shaw, Martinez, Mason Mount, injured this moment in time, but it's the type of recruitment that's important and how that money's spent that's really important. You know, a player like Oscar Bob also coming on, you know, who was Oscar Bob not too long ago, and look at how he's fitted into that team. Didn't get him in that expensively. He's still a young lad, obviously, in through that academy system. But isn't that the bigger conversation here in terms of that golfing class? Recruitment just doesn't seem to have been well thought of from a United perspective in comparison to where City are. And don't get me wrong, City have made mistakes historically when it comes to recruitment as well.
There is a massive gulf and chasm between the two teams and the two clubs right now. Of course, Erik ten Hag's going to say what he said, and you can understand that. And if things had worked out differently, it's not inconceivable that United could have got a result. They have done at City in recent years. You'll all remember back to when Pogba scored 2 as everybody was waiting to celebrate Manchester City winning the title in April 2018, and United won there. That's not sustainable. So yeah, quality, a bit of character and resilience and competitiveness. But what United need to embark upon now is a whole project to close the gap across the course of a season and individual matches and a consistent basis. And that's what brings us to your point. City know exactly what they're doing. There's a very clear plan of the style, the identity, where they are, where they want to go, and how they're going to get there. The roles and responsibilities of everybody involved, from the playing staff, the performance, the medical, the scouting, recruitment, loans, executives, all the way up, top to bottom of the club. And that's what Manchester United have lacked, especially since Sir Alex Ferguson left the club. So it's 11 years now. Under the Glazer ownership, there have been so many mistakes. There have been some good moments as well. But overall, the path has not been clear. The vision has not been instilled, at least effectively, and by people who know what they're doing. The plan and strategy around recruitment has not been there, or if it has, it has not been anywhere near the level it has needed to be. And you can see that in terms of, Laurie referenced, you know, say an Antony and an Amrabat coming off the bench in the last couple of games. These are players who were presumably identified to be starters. And this is what this whole INEOS project is presumably going to be about, in terms of identifying where things have gone wrong. And they're in that process now with the likes of Sir Jim Ratcliffe, who's really active, we hear. Sir Dave Brailsford, of course, Jean-Claude Blanc, and then the new executives will come on board, the likes of Omar Berada. I'll come on to that, by no coincidence, from Manchester City. Dan Ashworth, Jason Wilcox, by no coincidence, former Manchester City. And this will be possibly a slow, so people have to be patient, especially supporters, and they will say methodical process to try and bring Manchester United back to where they feel they belong, and perhaps even exceeding it in the future. It's an incredibly challenging project. It's probably really exciting for them as well. They're behind, and other clubs, not just Manchester City, your Liverpools, your Arsenal, even your Newcastle and Tottenham, they're ferociously pushing forward at the same time where Manchester and Chelsea, of course, too, Manchester United are trying to rebuild, and there will be pain. There will be bumps in the road. It is not going to be easy. Meanwhile, those clubs will continue in their minds to fly and sort of try and stretch the gap. But, you know, when you see a Berada taken and when you see Wilcox in the process of being taken, it's no coincidence that, and Sir Jim Ratcliffe speaking so complimentarily about Manchester City, it's almost like they're trying to replicate the structure in their own way, in a similar method, and it will be adapted for Manchester United. But just putting the right positions in, and it's not really rocket science. It's a pretty obvious journey to go on. And they will hope that in time puts them in a position where they are rising again. And Manchester United, we know with the history, the DNA, the fan base, the appeal, the historical identity, and the fall gives it the potential to be the biggest rise, you could say, in world football, in world sport. And it's their job to deliver that. And when you see those young players who were involved yesterday and have been recently, there's clearly the potential there. They need to get the recruitment right, and so much more besides. So there's no guarantee of success. But I do think, in terms of the steps United are putting into place, and INEOS in particular, their fans can be hopeful of a brighter future than the last decade or so that they've experienced.
You're listening to the Athletic FC podcast with Ayo Akinwolere.
Yeah, Laurie, let's not forget, it's taken City a while to get to where they've got to. Don't get me wrong, the jump off isn't of the same in terms of history as Manchester United. But, I mean, let's not forget the Joe years. I think you guys mentioned it on your podcast, the Wilfred Bonny years, you know, the Fernando years. Even Rabina, when he was there, was still a bit of an experiment at that point. Don't get me wrong, City have had gradual success for sure, but to get to a point where internally everything's sound, to have that manager that they've always wanted, to have the full backing and to make that recruitment seamless, I mean, it takes a while. And actually, let's temper, I guess, optimism with the INEOS conversation, in that actually this is not going to be a ready fix. All those components need to come into play, and then we'll start seeing the fruits of that labour as well.
Yeah, and I think that's something that Sir Jim Ratcliffe has said himself. You know, it's not going to be a light switch. But equally, he's not wanting to put this into the long distance and say, oh, you know, 10 years, we'll build to this team that might be challenging. No, he's sort of saying 3 years. He thinks 3 years is a fair sort of time to you know, get your house in order. But they are moving quickly. You know, obviously, as David's reported on, Omar Berada is a punchy move to appoint him as chief executive. You know, people weren't anticipating that. But that's somebody that they've identified as a highly skilled executive, fluent in many languages, has done the job on a commercial side and a football side. Come on, let's see what you can do as a chief executive. Same thing with Dan Ashworth. I think many people in the industry were basically saying to me, he's the guy that United should go and get because, okay, yeah, he's not a transfer guru as such, but I don't think there really is ever such thing as a transfer guru. There's people that can spot players and recruit well, but it's never just one person. It's a team collective usually. And Dan Ashworth has shown a kind of track record of building squads up, and you know, United is a structure that needs building up. As much as they will say that they have built a team already there, and you know, they feel that they're on a good path, the people that they've got in place there have not really done those roles before, and it's not, you know, they're kind of learning as much as, you know, they are experts in their own field, you know, to then bring it to United. So I feel like they're good appointments, but yeah, as you say, you know, United, it's going to take a bit of time to iron out the fact that they have overspent on players and probably committed wages to players that they can't really shift off the books, and that are unsatisfactory in terms of Antony, in terms of Jadon Sancho. You know, how are you going to kind of rejuvenate this squad with financial fair play considerations as well? They were only a kind of embryonic thing in City's time, and obviously, you know, they've now got 115 charges to answer at some point in the future, where, you know, they perhaps are alleged to have pushed the boundaries on what's permissible. So United will have to be, you know, I guess, alert to that fact. But I feel like, yeah, with Ineos, the way that they've come into the club has been invigorating for a lot of staff. It has been honest, frank talking about football failures and a recalibration of the club as a football club and not a commercial company, which has really, you know, rejuvenated people. And let's see, it is easier said than done, but it feels like they've got smart appointments so far, and they've definitely got the passion and drive to try and make this work.
But the biggest decisions are probably still around the corner, because Erik ten Hag is a subject of conversation that everybody seems to be asking us about right now, the manager's position more broadly. And I think that will be maybe the more significant test, because with your appointments like a Berada, potentially the Dan Ashworth, Jason Wilcox and more, the fruits of that labour is seen over many years, and it might not come to fruition until much further down the line. Whereas the head coach or manager, that is something that is in front of our eyes on the pitch immediately. And if there's to be a change, I don't know of there being a decision on that. It's something I'm sure which encompasses part of what they're looking at when they're conducting this audit in the early stages. A multitude of decisions need to be made, and this will be one of them. Ten Hag is under contract until 2025 with an option to go further. I'm sure they respect the job that he's done in very difficult circumstances so far, but they sound like they're quite ruthless, and so they'll be scrutinising the recruitment, the atmosphere around the club, the training methods and everything that goes into what Ten Hag does, and his coaches and analysts and medics. It's not just him by any means, but he's maybe the most high profile call that they have to make. And immediately you see reports around the industry of them looking at Graham Potter, of De Zerbi, of a Gareth Southgate, of is it Michel at Girona, and loads more. I think Zidane was mentioned as well. And these rumours and speculation and in some cases, credible reports are only natural when there are a lot of people involved and there are a lot of things that need to be sorted out. But you just feel that's on the horizon, the decision. And perhaps they say, no, actually, Ten Hag is the one we want to continue with. Maybe he qualifies them for the Champions League, and they say, that's actually not our most immediate concern. We'll continue with him. He's under contract, and we'll continue to make other changes. We'll see how he goes. He'll have to think about whether he wants to continue with them as well. Like, there's a two-way relationship here. And so I just think that this is going to come more and more sharply into focus. Every time there's a negative result, sections of the media, the fans, they really hone in on Ten Hag's position. And we do know that when new ownership or investment come into any club, there is often a change in this department early. Again, I'm not saying it's going to happen because I don't know it is, but it did happen at Chelsea. Thomas Tuchel had won the Champions League, and within a few months, he was out after the takeover. And there is pre-existing relations between Ineos and Potter, for example, because they spoke to him in light of the position at Nice. When people say Southgate, yeah, Dan Ashworth works with Southgate at the FA, and it sounds like Ineos know him quite well because Sir Dave Brailsford had some involvement at the FA. And then you've got the Omar Berada side of things, when he will have had ideas because he was in a very senior position at Manchester City. They've often been linked with De Zerbi, and then abracadabra, everybody's linking De Zerbi with Manchester United and Michel as well. So I just think this is naturally, in the coming weeks and months, whatever happens, going to be a really sharp subject of conversation.
Yeah, Laura, the managers is the interesting one, isn't it? Especially when you're thinking of making big changes, you know, changing an entire squad versus just changing one person could have either a boost or, you know, whatever. You know, I think about even Spurs going to City this season. I think it was in December. I mean, they had a depleted squad. I think it was Emerson Royale and Davis, a centre back, and they still got three goals, you know, and look what's happening there with the new manager, you know. That is definitely going to be, that's definitely going to have to be something the Ineos group are looking at for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you could also put Unai Emery in that category in terms of what he's getting out of his squad at Aston Villa. And that'll be something that Dave Brailsford is looking at to scrutinise. What kind of coaching sessions is Erik ten Hag putting on? What kind of messages is he giving the players? Do the players buy into it at all times? Is it the players that need to step up, actually, and maybe they're not quite understanding what ten Hag's asking for, and they should really be able to do these kind of things? It's very complicated what Pep Guardiola asks his players to do, and they take a bit of time to bed into it. So, you know, do you not give a coach that's trying to get players to do difficult things that latitude to actually, you know, produce when he's been supported by a structure, producing players, a recruitment side that actually you're not just basically going through your contacts book and thinking, who can we get as an emergency loan in January, which is obviously what happened with Wout Weghorst, for example. And yes, Ten Hag has obviously pushed his authority in certain moments, such as Antony, but that was at the end of the summer when he'd originally said, I wanted a striker, and United didn't get one, and then they kind of had to make do after the first couple of games had gone disastrously with a winger that they had to massively overpay for. You know, this is a guy that previous scouts had sort of looked at under Ole Gunnar Solskjaer and said was probably, you know, if we want to go for him, maybe 25 million, that kind of thing, and United end up paying, you know, sort of triple more than that value for him. So is that on Erik ten Hag? Maybe it is, because he's pushed for him, but also it's definitely on other people at the club, such as Richard Arnold, such as John Murta, who then, you know, committed to that kind of finance. So I do think what Ineos will want to do is take a holistic approach and trying to unpick it all. But clearly at the end of the season, they will look at things and trying to evaluate how much of that is the coach and how much of that is the players, and actually how do we sort of get United back challenging. You know, if they're in the Champions League, then that obviously gives Ten Hag much more credibility, gives them more finance to use. If they're not, maybe that is the defining factor, I don't know. But at the same time, I also do look around, and it was very clear who the best manager in the world was when City appointed Pep Guardiola. It was very clear that Jurgen Klopp had an incredibly compelling case at Liverpool. And let's remember that actually they had Brendan Rodgers as manager, who had done really well the previous season to get them challenging for the title. And then obviously they had that drop-off, and then the season after sort of started badly. But they were proactive in making that change. Maybe Ineos look at that and think, you know, that's kind of something. If there's somebody out there that we really love and really like and we want to go for, let's not wait around and go for him now. I do think that a couple of the names that David's touched on there, and Gareth Southgate and Graham Potter, might not be the kind of names that fans get excited about, but I do think that Ineos, the way that they work, the kind of structural processes they put in place, I could see those being kind of the head coach type that they would like to work with. But it is interesting, if they do decide to make a change, and I, like I said, I don't know that at all. I don't think that's been a decision that's been concluded whatsoever. And Erik ten Hag, for his part, every time that he's spoken, has, you know, said that they are aligned on their views. And he conveys a certain sense of, you know, sort of authority in that sense, Ten Hag. He hasn't looked brittle, I don't think, in these situations. Yeah, you might not agree with everything that he says, but he certainly carries himself with a sense of gravitas. And I do think you can't discount that, because Manchester United is such a huge job that, okay, you might have done well elsewhere. You know, even at Man City, you don't get the scrutiny that you do at Manchester United. And that is something that Ineos will have to weigh into the whole debate. And Erik ten Hag has shown that he can push back against the pressure that comes as Manchester United manager. So, yeah, lots to debate. And I do think it'll be a fascinating few weeks and months.
Gents, thanks so much for your time, David and Laurie as well. And please remember to rate and review the podcast if you're enjoying it. And we're also asking you to fill out a quick survey about you and your podcast habits by going to theathletic.com/survey24. Three lucky entries will win £100 or $100 worth of Amazon vouchers as well. So whether you're a long-time listener or just a new one, we want your feedback. Go to theathletic.com/survey24. That's theathletic.com/survey24. The link is also in the episode description. Thanks for listening.
The Athletic.